Okay, so today we are here with Maria Plodinek, the CEO of Artidis, which is an innovative new health tech which deals in the cancer realm. So I'll let Maria introduce a little bit of herself and her background, and then we'll jump into the technology. So Maria.
Hi, I'm Maria, and I'm the CEO of Artidis, and Artidis actually stands for Automated and Reliable Tissue Diagnostics, which doesn't mean much at the first, but actually at Artidis, we focus at addressing two major problems in clinics today. One is that the time to cancer diagnosis takes too long, and it's heavily relying on centralized labs, and we want to bring the diagnostics to the bedside, because that actually means when you take the actual biopsy that you use to diagnose cancer, you can analyze it on site and provide the first information to the patient immediately. And only for the patients that actually potentially have cancer, you can then prioritize the tissue for further analysis. So that really first helps a lot to patients because we reduce anxiety and stress. And second, you can also optimize the workflow in the hospital because you can really prioritize samples that are important. And second, what I think it's very interesting about our approach is that we can use the same type of technology to actually optimize therapy for patients that have cancer because we can directly measure the aggressiveness of tumors, and that allows us to really optimize the therapy ongoing as the patient is treated and measuring the tissues. So these are like the two major things that Artidis technology is able to bring to routine clinical setting.
So walk us a little bit through what it's like from the patient perspective right now through cancer treatment, because I saw that you mentioned overtreatment and time. So what does the patient go through when they're diagnosed?
I think that's probably the most important question to ask. It's not always perceived as the main question because we focus a lot on as to what are the costs for the hospital, how do we optimize processes for physicians, which is very, very important. But at the end of the day, the person that suffers the most in that process is the patient, because currently, if, for example, in case of breast cancer, you feel a lump, you will go for examination, then they will do imaging. Then after the imaging, they have a look, the physician and radiologist, they have a look, and okay, maybe there is something suspicious that we should biopsy. And then from the point that you tell a patient we are going to biopsy, imagine this is a high anxiety moment. And what is my experience from clinics? I have spent many years working also at the University Hospital in Switzerland, is that every patient at that point thinks I'm having cancer, even though majority don't have cancer. Actually, 70% of the patients that we actually take a biopsy of suspicious lesion, independent, it can be breast or some other organ, don't have cancer.
That's vaguely
So,
comforting.
yeah, that's actually very comforting, but you know, at that point in time when physician tells you now we're going to take a biopsy, all those 70% of the patients think I have cancer. And not just I have cancer, I'm going to die. And so the anxiety is enormous. And there are actually clinical studies that have shown that the stress hormones are at maximum level at this point. So this is more difficult time than when you actually find out that you have cancer. So what we really want to do is to provide opportunity to the patient and also empower the physician that you can actually tell patient at the point you extract the biopsy, is this cancerous or it's not cancerous? Because that provides relief to the patient and gives at the same time opportunities to physician to say, okay, if this is truly cancer in a sort of quantitative way, if we can measure that, then we can prioritize the sample and try to reduce anxiety, bring patients faster to the treatment planning with the relevant physicians. So I think it's really important to consider patients because it matters to them when they receive diagnosis. And currently in clinics, this can be anything from a couple of days, which is like 5 to 6 days that we see at MD Anderson or Baylor, so big hospital centers, to weeks if the patients are going to some local clinics, and then samples after excision are being transferred to some centralized lab to be analyzed. So this takes a long time, and this time is precious to the physician and especially to the patient.
It sounds like an immediate fight or flight reaction, but you have no options. You can't fight, and you can't really run away from it either. So you're just left there completely helpless.
Yes, yes.
From days to weeks.
Yes, and I think that's something that, for me, when I started working in the clinics, not as a physician, but kind of as a scientific observer, I was shocked how, for the system, these things are taken for granted. You know, this is what we have. These are the procedures we are doing. And so you just need to deal with that. And I think if we have technologies that are good and we can use to improve that, then I think it's very important to do our best to try to implement that in a routine clinical setting. And then similarly for treatment. In some instances, such as breast cancer, we have a lot of options nowadays to treat patients. And we are talking a lot, not anymore how to maximally treat, but how can we optimize the treatment? Because the treatment comes also with a lot of side effects. It's not given always that the positive sides of aggressive treatment are kind of overweighting the negative side. Sometimes the side effects are really dramatic. And so if the patient has no benefit of the treatment, it's very important to find ways how can we distinguish the patient groups that can benefit from certain treatment from the ones that don't, so we spare them from the aggressive treatment. Because I think in this time, day of and age, we should be also thinking, what is the quality of life we give to our patients? And this is a topic of discussion. I just came back from San Antonio breast cancer meeting. It's a very important topic that is now starting to be discussed. How do we de-escalate therapy? And so, but to do that, we need biomarkers. We need to be able to say with pretty good quantitative certainty that I'm not sparing a patient, and by doing that, I might kill this patient. So
you can't make any mistakes there. You have to be right exactly all the time.
And sometimes we really need to take kind of a calculated risk, if you like. It's really about outweighing the benefits versus the negative sides of treatment. And what we are trying to do with our technology is provide this quantitative part. So to say, if we have a test that can with pretty good certainty distinguish the patients that benefit from chemotherapy, that benefit from specific therapies, from the ones that don't, then this is the value that we can bring into clinical setting, which is for the patient and for the clinician to relieve them from the burden of making that decision themselves based on the overall data they have, but rather say, look, here is a biomarker that helps me to kind of make a quantitative decision that I can rely on. Yeah.
So one thing I think that a lot of people miss out on until they're in the mix and experiencing it is exactly how detrimental these treatments can be. A lot of the treatments are poisoning a lot of the cells around your body, and you're just hoping that two wrongs make a right and you can target the right cells, which really touches on how critical it is to make the right decision on whether or not to treat somebody.
Yes, absolutely. I think chemotherapy is one of the good examples. Mm. As we are progressing with scientific understanding, with new methods to also treat, better methods to treat, new modern drugs, we also see that we can do a lot to reduce the amount and time period that we give chemotherapy to patients. That's just one very key example that addresses the point you are mentioning. And I think two wrongs do not make it right. So we need to get better at this, because we have seen significant improvements. I think in breast cancer, we see patients even living a couple of years with very late stage metastatic cancer. So we are turning cancer into a chronic disease more and more. So I think the next step for all the stakeholders, users. And this is where technology such as what we are developing, and I will later mention a bit more how do we do that actually, are important to help make those decisions. So how do we really decide on how to move forward with treatment decisions? And I think exactly because these patients are coming into kind of a chronical stage of disease, we need to care about quality of life. We mm-hmm. need to care about long-term side effects. And so that makes it even more important to look for tools that will help in that.
I'll take manageable over fatal any day. But it's interesting because we're going to start to see things that we haven't seen before, these aggressive cancers turning into chronic diseases.
Yes. Yes.
There's going to be a lot of pleiotropic effects that we won't even have noticed before. But this is a perfect segue into the technology of Artidis. But it sounds amazing the way that you've taken a different kind of perspective, which touches on things like the softness of the cells, and you can use that as a diagnostic. So tell us a little bit about how it works.
Yeah, so I think that's something that's really exciting about our technology. It's not based on a genetic biomarker or a biochemical biomarker, but it's actually a physical biomarker. And technology behind Artidis uses a very sharp sensor that basically works like palpation. You know, something that every patient experienced at least once going to a doctor. But instead of a hand, Artidis has this very sharp sensor that literally touches the tissue. And by making tens and thousands of these small palpations, we can create physical profiles of all different components within the tissue. And what is interesting is the different cells, be it healthy or cancerous or different type of cancer or different stage of progression of cancer, have different physical properties or different stiffness. And you might ask yourself, how can that in any way relate to cancer? But actually, it has to do a lot with how cancer progresses, because did you ever think about how does a cell from a breast or lung end up in a liver or bone or brain, which are actually this distant metastasis that kill the patient? It's not the primary tumor. It's those cells that can spread and move that are actually the killers, right?
It's a long way for a cell to travel.
Exactly. And in order to do that, they need to be able to squeeze through all different tissue parts. So the mechanism behind is actually pretty simple. And we want to find out which of these cells that are able to do that are present in the primary tumor when we measure biopsies, or in the metastasis when we look at late stage patients. And if we find those very soft, squishy cells, we know that this is a very aggressive tumor that we need to approach in a different way than the tumors that don't have those cells. And there are ways to treat that, actually. And we are exploring those opportunities now.
It sounds a little bit like a bioengineering miracle that you're able to, you know, have tactile sensation with so many different cells. It sounds like a giant conveyor belt and cells are passing along and they're able to be touched by this probe. I mean, there's so many different factors coming in. You need diagnostics, which I'm sure takes a lot of computing. You need engineering, and then you need biological impacts of knowing how cancer develops. I mean, your team must be amazing.
I mean, absolutely. Thank you. I think my team is truly amazing, but it's also many, many years of basic science that has led to that. And when we started, we kind of built on a lot of things that were there. And the whole concept of this mechanobiology, which describes how physical properties of cells and matrices, so different tissue components, contribute to normal organ development, to healthy state, and also how this changes in cancer, has been a topic of research for a couple of decades. And it was interesting that 15 years ago, when I started my PhD studies at University of Basel in Switzerland, this was kind of a very early emerging hot topic to work on. And I was quite excited to take on the project, because at the time, we didn't think about technology per se, or we didn't even think about bringing it into clinics. We just wanted to understand the biology. how does something physical can contribute to certain biological phenotypes that are normal, that we see in cell culture, that we see in our body. And what was interesting for me, that actually I had to switch that a little bit. It's not that this contributes, it's kind of a natural outcome of different biological processes. So, you know, certain cells consist of certain proteins, certain scaffolds, and our nature works very smart. So they are kind of created as such on purpose in order to be able to create a functional organ, because the mechanics of a lung is going to be very different than mechanics of, for example, liver or some other organ, because with lungs we breathe, so we need to expand them and then compress, expansion, compression. So the cells and the type of events that are happening there is very different. And it was incredible to see how much of sort of basic physical concepts are part of a biology. And I think working on that, we also learned that we can use different microscopies and technologies to probe these mechanics. And that's how came the notion that we can use this sharp sensor to actually look at mechanics of different tissues. And the technology, when I started my PhD, was pretty much, it's called atomic force microscopy, and the name tells it, it was not meant for biology. So it was basically, the idea of atomic force microscopy was to look at very flat materials in physics or material science, where you can look at molecules or even atoms, how they're put together to create a material of certain properties. And typically those materials would be conductive. So you would use a type of microscopy called scanning tunneling. Or if the samples are non-conductive, then you would use atomic force microscopy, where the two atoms would touch, and by touching you would measure the properties. So they have nothing to do with biology. But we realized that this technology can be actually applied to biology. And as I described, we can use it to measure all these physical interactions within the cells. But the next step that we needed to do is to adapt it. Here comes the engineering part, because it was not meant to be for biology, for liquid big samples. And so we had to do a lot of engineering to automate it, to make it more precise, that we can put the whole piece of tissue inside in a special liquid that doesn't degrade the tissue, in order that we can look at these processes in a physiological setting that is similar as much as possible to what we find in a human body. And during this whole process, we realized, wow, we can actually use that to distinguish cancer cells from normal cells, to actually subtype different cancer cells. And so this was very exciting when you realize that something you are doing in the lab actually can potentially have a clinical application. And it ended up as a very nice publication, for starters, in Nature Nanotechnology. We also had a featured cover.
Wow, that's major.
Yeah, and so that was great. And at that point, I think we thought, okay, this is great science, and we can continue to look further. But talking to some of our clinical collaborators, we realized that there might be a lot of opportunities to actually try to test that in a clinical setting. But as the device was looking at that point, very bulky and manual, and it takes hours to prepare everything, it was clear that this is never going to work in a clinical setting. And so that was kind of a decision where you say, okay, maybe somebody else should take over and build this medical device, or we really try, because we understand the science and we understand how it should work to bring it to the clinics. So why don't we try to build a very first prototype ourselves and do some first tests? And if that works well, then we take it to the next level. And that's how slowly the whole project started.
It's really interesting how cell differentiation works, because things go from one cell and they differentiate and split and they take a million branches. A couple wrong turns and you end up with cancer. But yes. at the end of the day, it's all very mathematical and almost predictable.
Yes.
So being able to use these systematic predictions takes the magic out of it. You know, you can dictate exactly what's good and what's bad and what's to be expected and what is not supposed to be there. So here we are, and you have this concept in mind and you want to commercialize. What is that process like when you have a great idea and you need to make a great project or product?
Yeah, so I think that's interesting to look from the perspective now when we are already in the commercialization, and looking back when we started, it actually started much more innocent. You know, we went to talk to our tech transfer office. We said we would like to patent this. And so they said, yeah, we need to do first a patent search to see if this is even patentable. Very quickly, we realized that there is nothing similar anywhere. So it was easy to file for the first patent. And then we had what was, I think, very interesting, and I know that there are similar approaches in US, a couple of these technology grants, which gives you really time with sufficient funds to build the very first prototypes and test them in a clinical setting and see if that's feasible to bring to the next level, which means basically starting a startup and considering creating a product. And so we had these grants from the Swiss Innovation Agency. They were it was a very successful project, and as a consequence of that, we started to collaborate with a company in Switzerland that would produce such devices, albeit for basic biology and material research. And that was a very interesting experience because that particular project failed with that company. Oh. And at the time, my personal idea was that, you know, we're going to collaborate with the experts that know how to make products and they know how to make business. And we're going to keep on going our science and support them in bringing that to the market. And when this particular collaboration failed, I think that was a very important step because that was like a notion that I realized, okay, now we need to do it because either we do it or it's not going to happen. And I think from that point on, it became very clear what the next steps will be. And so we came together as a team, the key founders of the team, we came together and said, okay, now we're going to do it. And we have built the very first prototype. We started a clinical trial in 2016, which I'm proud to say to date closed in May this year and recruited 545 patients. Where we could test initially in the proof of concept our technology. And when that first step worked successfully, then we took it from there. We of course raised funds that would help us to get to the next level. And so 18 months later, we are now at the stage where we have a medical device that we are just about to place in a couple of institutions within the Texas Medical Center and also in Europe. We are starting large multi-center clinical trials, and we are going to see how this basic concept of palpation actually works in a routine clinical setting to bring value to those two points that I mentioned in the beginning. Let's do bedside diagnostics. Let's try to optimize therapy. And there it's not just about, you brought a little bit about the concept of physics. It's not just about this measurement. What we have developed is a platform that actually, in addition to our biomarker, integrates all clinical data from patient into a structured database that allows us not just to store these data in a structured way, but to use them for meaningful analytics. And only by integrating different clinical data with our TIDIS data, we can truly optimize the therapy setting. So I think this is maybe something that's very important to mention, especially at this point in time where the value of data is being brought out and mentioned so much, and AI and machine learning, and
it's the hot topic.
It's all these hot topics, right? But what is very important is that we make sure that the data we gather are of good quality. It's not so much about high numbers and millions of data, but actually that we have infrastructure where we can ensure that we can collect data that are accurate, that are well curated for each individual patient. Because it doesn't matter so much if we can do wonderful analytics on 200,000 patients retrospectively. Mm-hmm. We need to be able to use our models to predict what's going to happen to the patient that comes tomorrow morning into the clinics based on that model. And for that, you need very good quality of data. And so we try to, within our database, to make sure that we collect our mechanical data and then for each patient individualized parameters that describe the disease. And for example, in a Swiss trial, we had for each of the patient up to 180 clinical parameters gathered in addition to mechanical parameters. And so that's the value that allows us to optimize therapy.
So you're taking the blanket away from treatment and you're allowing individualization.
Yes.
Which may be much more effective with much less detriment to the patient.
Yes.
Beautiful. Yes. It sounds like your whole experience with trials went really smooth. Is that because, you know, it can be done in conjunction with other sensory kind of things and it's extraneous to the patient, so there's not a lot of danger posed to the patient? How did you get through everything so smoothly?
Yeah, I think it's really about the risk. So because our technology doesn't in any way damage the patient, it doesn't require any additional procedures that you wouldn't do otherwise. So how this works in a clinical setting, it's really for every patient that qualifies for a biopsy procedure. Once the biopsy is excised, we can do this measurement on site. In a very easy way. So we have developed tools that allow direct transfer of the biopsy from the biopsy procedure holder that is used routinely in all clinics worldwide. So that makes the process last only 20 seconds. So physician can take the biopsy out of the patient, put it in the sample holder and load it into the device all within a minute.
That is bedside. That's as bedside as it can get.
And then it takes an hour roughly to measure the sample, but while the patient does some other tests and so on, it's in the clinic, so you can do this in real time within the office. And very important, this biopsy is not damaged by Artidis measurement in any way, which means that in case you want to do any additional genetic or biochemical test on that biopsy, you can use the same sample. And that's also important when we want to demonstrate accuracy of our technology. We can directly benchmark it with any other technology that is routinely used in clinics to analyze those biopsies.
Interesting.
So I think that's truly the value, that there is no harm to the patient and it can only be beneficial in terms of time and accuracy. And this is also the reason why we had no resistance. We had very good support from the patients and also from the clinicians, because it minimally disrupts their daily workflow.
That is very impressive. So you are the CEO of something that may change diagnostic cancer forever.
That's the goal we're working on.
What has your experience been like being a CEO? How have you adapted to going into the top of the business world from academia?
I think this is now something at this point with so much different technologies and data that is quite essential. I think it's very important to understand what is the unique value that your technology has and how you would place it in a clinical setting. So I think that scientific background and also clinical background, I'm not a physician, I'm a physicist, but I spent some years working in a clinical setting, are very, very helpful. Albeit saying that, of course, it has been a quite significant change from moving from that university clinical setting to a business setting. And I think one of the major things, differences that we see and that I experience is how you think about the whole funding process, right? In terms of university, if you have a good project, you will get your grants, you will get support from the university. It's not easy as it sounds, but it's definitely easier than when you are out there and now you need to go and raise money for your project that might be in a very early stage. When we talk about seed, when we started raising money, we were in the middle of the trial, we had proof of concept, we did have a business plan, but I think also the more new technology is, it's a challenge to present it to the investor in a way that they can understand, because they're not necessarily domain experts. They don't know everything about physics and palpation and models and mathematics and, you know, stuff we were just talking about. And so how do you bring them to the level they understand what they can do, what you can do. And that was for me the most difficult.
How do you market yourself completely differently?
Yeah, absolutely differently. And how do you make it simple with clear messages in, you know, that after 10 minutes, they love it, right? I think that's the most difficult thing to do. And it took a lot of practice. This is not something I think you need to have. Obviously, you need to be able to communicate. Some aspects of that need to come naturally. I think if you take this job as a CEO, you need to be able to transfer the information. But there is a lot of practice there. There's a lot of practice. And I think one of the most important things was how I can at best bring across the technology that I'm working on. And I think initially, a lot of these early stage investors have to understand a little bit what you do, because otherwise it's difficult to raise money. So that was helpful in our case, that we attracted smart money. So these were people that actually came from the medical field or oncology or medical devices. So they had some understanding. And then over time, you really learn to bring it to the level that you can pitch it anywhere. And I have to say, one of the really amazing experiences as we sit now within TMC was being part of the TMC program, medical device cohort. I think I have learned a lot during this period, couple of months being here, how to present, how to improve the messaging across to make clear what your product and technology is.
It's a hard gap to go from science, where everything is black and white, to the more emotional side, where you have to convince people. So being able to get outside perspective from a program like the TMC cohort is game-changing for a lot of companies. Mm-hmm. To be able to get that tool development that they may never had to use before.
Yeah.
Up next, Maria touches on reflections as well as future technologies. But first, a word from our sponsor.